recipe for controversy. Furman University has a reputation for attracting conservative students, and it's located in a county where Mr. Bush won two-thirds of the 2004 vote. But now, with the president's speech just 10 days away, his appearance has sparked opposition on campus, and NPR's Adam Hochberg reports from Greenville.
It's not so much the students who are upset about President Bush coming to Furman. Most of the 650 graduates here either feel honored by the president's visit or don't care much as long as they still get their diplomas. Instead, the protest is being led by Furman professors. In dozens of office windows on this well-groomed suburban campus are black and white posters that say, "We object."
Those are all faculty offices.
And they all have little protest signs.
The "We object." Yeah, and if you were to walk down here in Furman Hall, you'd probably see a number of them.
Carmela Epright is one of more than 200 professors who signed a petition opposing Mr. Bush's visit. That's about half of Furman's faculty. They say they're ashamed of his policies on Iraq, the environment, and other issues.
We're giving him a platform to speak to us. It's not a critical platform. There's not going to be discussion. There's not going to be a question and answer period. We worry that we're condoning his policies.
Some professors who signed the petition plan to boycott graduation. They're seeking conscientious objector status to a university policy that requires them to attend. Others plan to listen to the president, but psychology professor Judy Grizel says they may wear armbands or T-shirts.
I feel obliged to say that I object. I object to what he has done to the country, to international policy, and I'm appalled that he is going to be speaking as if, you know, he were someone that we would want to emulate.
These kinds of controversies aren't unusual this time of year. Earlier in his administration, President Bush sparked protests when he gave commencement speeches at St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania and Calvin College in Michigan. But at Furman, student body president Christina Henderson says the protest is not popular with this year's graduating class.
We want the focus still to be on the seniors, and we think that the protest is taking away from what graduation really is about.
Henderson is a Democrat, a relative rarity among students here. She even worked for Hillary Clinton's campaign. But she says professors should show respect for Mr. Bush's title, even if they dislike his policies. Other Furman students have gone further in criticizing the faculty. Nathan Gwynn is part of a campus conservative group that's labeled the protest an embarrassing publicity stunt.
The message that's getting out to the media is that Furman doesn't want the president here, and it makes us look very arrogant, I believe, for people who love to use the language of tolerance and acceptance to endure a 20-minute speech from the president of the United States we felt like was a worthwhile request.
University administrators say they're trying to stay neutral, agreeing to the presidential visit because that reflected the will of the student body. Faculty leaders weren't consulted. Furman President David Shai says he encourages a vigorous campus debate, but he admits apprehension about what may happen graduation day.
I think anyone would be concerned about the possibility of uncivil behavior at a ceremony that is steeped in significance. Although I certainly can't control that, I can hope that our faculty will behave very appropriately for the occasion.
In addition to speaking at Furman, President Bush is scheduled to deliver another commencement address this month, but it's very unlikely there will be protesters at that one. It's at the Air Force Academy, where students and most faculty members take an oath to support the Commander-in-Chief. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Greenville, South Carolina.
It's 2:46. Coming up in 14 minutes on The World, rival leaders in Lebanon agree to a peace deal which breaks the political deadlock in the country. A new book says U.S. intelligence agencies are outsourcing highly sensitive work to private contractors. And a food expert who's organized a special feast called 10 Foods to Eat Before They Die. That's coming up on The World at 3 o'clock this afternoon here on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards.
When you think of roller skating, what comes to mind is middle school boys chasing each other, girls striking poses, but there's another demographic that's formed its own skating subculture in Chicago's southern suburbs and in northwestern Indiana. And these folks say skating's given them new life and renewed health, and it's not just reserved for kids. Lynette Kalsness reports.
Brakes. A dozen people whiz around the roller rink at the Linwood Sports Center. Some glide by backwards, and others execute graceful turns. One man does several tricky jumps, falls, then tries again. Linwood is exactly what you'd expect of a roller rink. There's a disco ball and brightly colored lights. Except the skaters are in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s.
I'm addicted to roller skating. It's social, it's the music, it's the movement, the endorphins you build. It just exercises your whole body. You feel like you're flying.
Carol Rodrian lives in Tinley Park. Rodrian quickly weaves between the other skaters, then swings a foot out in a gentle kick and speeds by on one leg. She's 68, but she looks a good decade or two younger.
Now, I have to admire the sparkly tights that you're wearing here. Tell me about your outfit.
I have about 64 skating outfits and probably 40 pairs of different colors of tights. But I can't skate in pants. It's too binding, too confining, too restrictive. I have to have shorts or short skirt.
Rodrian is part of an informal group of roller skating seniors. They skate to organ music at a half dozen rinks in the southern part of the region. Like Loretta Galovich, most skated as kids and stopped when they got married.
Then I got 60 and fat and high cholesterol and was told I had to lose weight, get more exercise. And I said to the doctor, how's about roller skating? He says, that is wonderful. That's equivalent to running. It's very good.
At 75, Galovich doesn't do any fancy turns or jumps, but she skates briskly. And after just a few minutes of talking, she's eager to get back at it. Galovich learned to skate as a kid, growing up in the streets near the steel mills.
You went to Goldblatt's and you bought a pair of metal skates that you clamped onto your shoes for $1.59, and you got the skate key free, and you didn't go anywhere without those.
For many, skating is nostalgic. During World War II, Santo Dugetti served in the Navy, and he brought his skates with him. Skating is how Dugetti, who's 83, met his wife after the war.
I was skating at the Armory, didn't know her from Adam. And as I was coming out of the rink, I ran into this young lady, knocked her down, she tore her stockings, bruised her knee, and then she got mad at me. She told me I had to take her home and pay for her stockings and her everything else. Then from then on, then I start dating her, and before you know it, I end up marrying her. That was true skating. Ain't that something?
For other skaters, skating can be like therapy. That's what helped Bonnie Demas deal with her grief after her husband died. She had friends she'd skated with as a teen, and they dragged her back out to the roller rink in her mid-60s.
They said, you know, what are you doing with your life? Why don't you come back and join us? So I did.
That's not to say those first cautious steps back into the rink were easy.
Scary. Very. They skated with me, one on one side, one on the other side, for probably 3 or 4 weeks, and then they said, okay, now you're on your own.
As far as skating, what is your repertoire?
Just going around and staying on my feet.
First dance will be the glide waltz.
At the nearby Glenwood roller rink, a DJ calls out dance numbers. The circling couples waltz, tango, and polka on roller skates. They swing their legs out in unison, then lean deeply into the turns, holding the position as they cut across the rink. Not everybody dances. Carolyn Stats recovering from a fall, so she's a bit tentative on her wheels. She skates slowly around the rink, and her husband is right behind her.
My children would try to, you know, think it's time for me to stop skating at this age, but not my children as much as my sisters. You know, don't you think it's time? And I'd say, it's no different. I fell down at home. What's the difference, you know? You're going to hurt yourself, you're going to hurt yourself, but it's too much fun. I don't want to stop.
Last number is Werner Tango.
That's how Carol Goldsmith feels, too. It was here at Glenwood 23 years ago that she met her husband, Oliver.
I was always afraid of, like, getting old, you know, and I was 43, and when I saw those lights go down and everybody waltzing around, I thought, if this is what getting old's about, I'm ready.
Her husband is 83, and he's had some health problems, but he still joins her from time to time. This afternoon, they sit in the snack bar and she helps him lace up his skates. Then they slowly enter the rink, holding hands. I'm Lynette Kalsnes, Chicago Public Radio.
It's 2:53 in the afternoon. Lester Graham of the Environment Report recently talked with Gus Speth. Gus Speth is the dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale and the author of a new book titled The Bridge at the Edge of the World.
We did do some cleaning up, and we certainly rounded out a lot of the rough edges, but despite that, we are in a very dire situation now, I believe. The global warming issue, disruptive climate change coming at us, is the most potent environmental threat that we've ever experienced. You know, meanwhile, we've been losing an acre a second of tropical forests for decades now. We're consuming vast quantities of fresh water from our streams and rivers. Flock of rivers no longer reach the ocean in the dry season around the world. We are overfishing 75% of the marine fisheries. 90% of the large predator fish in the oceans are gone. Half the wetlands are gone. We're extinguishing species 1,000 times the rate of natural extinction. So these are very serious problems.
You suggest in your book that tackling environmental problems will require us all to stop looking at things with such a narrow view. The environment is connected and affected by business and government or lifestyle or, in other words, capitalism, democracy, and consumerism. Do you want to change the world? Is that what it's going to take?
Well, I think quite literally we have all got to be out to save the world at this point, and I think these issues are linked. We forget sometimes that the real thing that is undermining the environment is economic activity. And this growth carries with it enormous potential for increased environmental destruction. Now, the problem is companies have enormous incentive not to pay their environmental costs, to push these costs off onto other people and onto future generations. The result is that the prices that for their products are environmentally dishonest.
Can you give me an example of a case like that?
Well, I would say any oil or coal company and us in using the oil and the coal in our electricity and in our homes or whatever, we're paying nothing compared with the environmental cost that the use of the fossil fuels is imposing on our environment and on our own human health. And in that basic arrangement is buttressed by enormous power now on the part of the corporate sector. Not only are they the principal economic actors in our system, but they're the principal political actors in our system now. It's buttressed by our own consumerism, our own pathetic capitulation to the advertising machine that we face every day. And it's buttressed by government, which is really wholly dependent now on growth for raising extra taxes without having to raise tax rates and for holding out the promise of better lives, which don't materialize.
That's Gus Speth, the dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale, talking about his new book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World. He spoke with The Environment Report's Lester Graham.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about The Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
We want you to join us before you take off for the summer and your vacation on June the 6th, Friday, 2 weeks from this Friday, for our first annual summer celebration on AM 580. Get into the summer spirit and help us reach our end-of-the-year fundraising goal with your pledge of support. The summer celebration's coming up on Friday, June the 6th. The
Mm-hmm.